Hello and welcome to Knitcast, the podcast about knitting, with me, your host, Marie Urshard. Well, this 13th edition has been a while in the making because of my recent illness, and I want to start off by thanking you all for your wonderful emails and comments. They really helped me during this difficult time, and I'm feeling a lot better now. My special guest for this edition is Lynn Hirschberger of Colourjoy.com. I spoke to Lynn via the Gone Wide Cyber Cafe in Lansing, and if you listen very carefully, you may hear some coffee being prepared in the background. Now, you can't talk to Lynn without mentioning socks and sock knitting. So I started off by asking how she got into sock knitting.
Well, I've always loved socks. They're bright colors, and I was a child of the 70s. So Twiggy and Laffin and all that, all these bright colors of the 70s. Even in years where we haven't had bright colored clothing, we've had bright colored socks. So I've always been sort of obsessed with that. I have small feet, and so I often couldn't get socks that fit well, and I love wool, and so I was sort of obsessed with finding bright colored wool socks that were small, which was nearly impossible to find. So when I went surfing the internet about wool for some other thing, I found sockknitters.com, and I knew my life would change, and it certainly has. That was about 4 years ago.
And you've knit a lot of socks in that time, because I know I've seen your sock gallery.
I've knit 119 pairs of socks in the last 4 years.
Wow. Are they all in the sock gallery on your website?
No, the Lynn H. Sock Tour has 33 pairs of socks on it. When I did that, I didn't have a digital camera, and so it was a bit of a hassle to roll a film, go get it developed, scan it all in. So I kind of got tired of that. I do have a lot of them since then together, so I'm in the process of thinking about maybe doing a second sock tour. But I don't have photos of all of the socks since that time. Most of them, but not all.
And when did your actual sock designing come into play?
Very soon. I was lucky because the first pattern I used was more of a guide to how to fit to your own foot. And so I followed that little pattern guide for the first maybe 3 or 4 pairs. And after that, I just kind of started on my own. The first sock that I did as a pattern was my 13th pair. I did a sock in stranded, what we sometimes call Fair Isle knitting, although it's not of the Fair Isle tradition. It was for a friend's daughter named Eva. And people kept writing me and saying, "Where did you get that pattern? I want that pattern." And I said, "There is no pattern. I made it up." So enough people wrote that I wrote it up, and that was only my 13th pair of socks. I didn't really start out to be a designer. It just sort of happened.
I understand that actual socks and sock knitting sort of reignited your interest in knitting.
That's right. I learned how to knit in fifth grade from Mr. Johnson, who was my fifth grade teacher. And we were in a temporary location between schools. They were building a school. So here we were, a bunch of fifth graders with no place to go if it rained. And so I think he just learned enough knitting to teach us. So I learned a backward loop cast on and a knit stitch. And I never learned how to roll or crease or decrease. And I knit like that for 20 years, making scarves for Christmas presents. And that's all I wanted to do. I was very happy with that. And then I gave it up. Well, I guess I had a friend from Germany and learned that you could do more. Took a class, learned how to knit and purl and follow a pattern, and then quit. My first marriage was not doing well, and I gave up pretty much everything creative at that point to try to make it go. But then I got happy again, and I decided I wanted to try something other than polymer clay, which was my artwork for 10 years. And so I just started trying different things, and I tried some felt making, and the felt making led to the search for wool on the internet, which led to sock knitters. And as I said, I knew my life would change, and it really did.
Now, you've said that you also have worked with polymer clay as well, and you've also been involved with felting as well.
Yes, I started out, when I started finding my artistic self again, I found polymer clay, and it was very bright colors. At that time, I was making beads, although I got out of that very quickly and got into wall pieces and polymer clay kazoos and some other fun, funky things. But I did that for about 10 years, really obsessively, like not sleeping, staying up till 4. Then I just kind of got so that I was sort of burned out on it. I can tell you a million reasons why that should be your medium. but I had just done so much of it that I didn't want to sit down in the studio. So I started trying anything that sounded good, and I took a bookmaking class from my friend Susan Hensel. And I found that when we were sewing the spine, that I really missed fiber and I missed pulling a thread. So she put me in touch with Nancy McRae, who's a weaver in town, and Nancy told me about a workshop on felt making by Joan Livingstone, who is a professor of art at the Chicago Institute of Art. And I just lucked out that my first felt making class was from this world-class artist. So that made me really clear that I missed my wool. I used to do a lot of sewing when I was married the first time, and I loved wool the best. I started dyeing roving when I did the Fabric of Friendship felt making project. This was a public felt making project we made. I made felt with people who were important in my life, with my mother, my goddaughter Sarah, and other friends. And we made these big pieces together, and it was kind of a metaphor. The fibers became one, like our relationship, and so the different colors represented different aspects of our lives. So I started dyeing yarn first with Kool-Aid because I could do it without buying new equipment for my kitchen at the time. And that worked pretty well for most of the colors I needed. But as you know, I love purple. And purple Kool-Aid in the United States is a very disappointing gray color. And I absolutely had to have a bright color purple, especially one of my friends to use in our piece. I knew she would want purple to represent herself. So I went to my friend Marlene Cameron, who's in the Working Women Artists Group with me, and she's dyed silk for a long time. And also Nancy McRae gave me some dye, and between the two of them, I borrowed some equipment and some dye, and I dyed a couple purples. And so that got me into the commercial dyes. I just had to have the right purple.
And you do sell your dyed yarns and rovings via your website. Do you have a favorite medium? I mean, is wool your absolute favorite medium?
I consider that color is my medium. I would rather touch wool than anything right now. And it's so portable. You can't do polymer clay in a car or a hammock, you know? You can always knit socks, no matter where you are, pretty much. That makes me a little bit more inclined to always keep a sock in my bag.
Now, you were saying that colour is your medium, and certainly by reading your blog and looking at your work, I know that turquoise is your favourite colour. How has your colour sense developed over the years? Is that something you've sort of actively worked on, or do you just have a natural colour sense?
I think I've always been focused on colour. I remember my childhood by colours. I remember when I was only about 2 years old, I remember walking to a friend's house that had a toy that was blue and yellow and red. We found a drawing I did when I was still writing my letters backwards. I drew it in purple and magenta crayons, and my mother's a very frugal woman and would never have bought me more than 8 colors of crayons, so I don't know where I got a magenta crayon, but I clearly was focused on these colors when I was too young to write.
Working with colour can be intimidating for some people. Is there any advice that you give for people who want to work with colour, but maybe they're a bit worried about making a mistake?
I teach a wonderful class, and we call it Colour Joy Stole because you end up with this wonderful froofy stole with 5 yarns. But it's not just a class about that. It's about how yarns are made and how to put colours together. And I think the thing that was really life-changing for me about understanding color was taking just a basic art class that was about color, and it talked about, we say dark blue or light green, and we sort of leave out one element of color. Dark would be called value. That's how light or dark it is. Blue is the hue. But there's this other thing called chroma or intensity or saturation. And that's whether it's got some gray in it or whether there's absolutely no gray and it just hurts your eyes. My ex-husband used to try to insult me because I like bright colors, and he said I like retina-damaged colors. When you find that people are mixing colors and it doesn't work, it's usually, in my experience, because the chroma is not the same between the colors in the pile of yarn.
But you've also been teaching computer classes for children, and I understand that those classes also led to knitting classes. How did that happen?
Actually, I started out teaching computer classes to retirees. And I did have a full-time job doing computer training for 6 years. But the community center, it was right down the street from my house that I bought when I was single. And I first taught the classes to the retirees, and then we decided to open the lab for the public to come in. And what happened then, of course, was that the neighborhood children came down to play games. And my job was just to make sure that they were safe and that the equipment didn't walk away. And so I would sit in the corner and I would knit while they were playing computer games. And then every once in a while, a child would just come over and beg, you know, please give me some sticks, give me some string. And it wasn't really an appropriate time for that. And I didn't have the resources to really do it. But I went then to my supervisors there and said, we really should do a knitting class for the kids. And it took me 2 years to convince them, but it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. It's just the most rewarding thing to take a child, and I was young as five, although most of the kids are about third or fourth grade. They understand the magic. You know, you give them some sticks and string, and they can make something. And usually we start with just 5 stitches of garter fabric, and we make a wristband. And that's cool because sports figures wear wristbands. It's a big basketball thing, and the boys do it and the girls do it, and everybody thinks it's cool, and they really understand the magic of it. And I do have one girl who's making socks. She's on her second pair, and a lot of kids have made backpacks and that sort of thing. It's just a wonderful experience, and of course, just being an important adult in these children's lives is something I really didn't expect, but it's just been a wonderful part of my life.
And what's the name of the program?
It's called City Kids Knit, with an exclamation point.
I understand that you're looking for donations for supplies.
We're always running out of needles, Marie. It's not hard for me to get yarn for some reason. I do let the children, once they get to the point where they don't need me, I let them take some knitting home. And then if they forget their knitting at home when they come back to the room, they can have another set of needles that they can use in the room with their name in a bag, which means every child that I gets 2 sets of needles. And I've had days where I've had 16 children, and since it's a walk-in program, I can have new kids every day. So I'm always just desperately low on knitting needles. What they like are the straights usually, but I can use some circulars that are smaller, like for hats or bag. I can take double points, and we put rubber bands on the bottom to help them keep it up. The ideal is a size 8 US, which is a 5mm needle. That's the ideal. You can go a little bit either way from that size.
So if someone listening to this has got something which they think, some needles or some other supplies that they think you might be interested in for the program, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
They can send me an email at Lynn, L-Y-N-N, at colorjoy.com, or they can send the needles directly to Foster Community Center, attention Lynn, 200 North Foster Avenue, Lansing, Michigan, 48912, and that's in the USA.
And I'll also make sure that that information is on the KnitCast blog as well. Now, we've been talking about your fiber art, but you are an all-round artist, and you're also a belly dancer.
That's right. I have perhaps multiple personalities. I always like to think of it as personas. Online, I'm Lynn H., and when I sing with my husband, I'm Lynn Heftone, and when I dance, I'm Eudora.
And has knitting featured at all in your belly dance group at all? I know that you have a gift exchange every year.
That's true. I have done a lot of knitting for my friends that I dance with and for their children. Not as much, but one of the girls in the troupe had a 3-pound baby 3 years ago. She's doing really well right now, but that was my first lace project, was to knit a lace dress for this child who's now doing just very well. I knit for the ladies when I pull their names. I'm getting more into knitting for, actually, the dance costume, we'll dance top, that started my mind churning, so we'll see where that goes. I don't know yet.
Tell us a bit more about the group that you're in with your husband, Brian.
Our music group is called the Fabulous Heftones, H-E-F-T-O-N-E-S. Someone named us, we didn't name ourselves, but the instrument that I play is called a heftone. It's a stand-up acoustic bass, and it looks like a large banjo, but it's as tall as me. My husband plays ukulele, which is this small little Hawaiian instrument, although we don't usually do Hawaiian music. We tend to do the popular music of the 1920s, well, anywhere from the late 1800s to 1929. So we do things like By the Light of the Silvery Moon and I Want a Girl Just Like the Girl That Married Dear Old Dad, Paddlin' Madeline Home, which is not well known, but I love the title. Brian is an excellent instrumentalist and particularly ukulele player. So we do the circuit of the ukulele festivals, including the Midwest Ukulele Festival, which we will be playing in October for the second year. And we'll also be in Greenwich Village in April of 2006. There's a New York festival. I'm a trained singer. My voice was my major when I first started college. So I have this sweet, lovely voice and a bass. And Brian has this amazing ukulele playing. Brian maintains a website called heftone.com. And that includes information about my instrument, which was built and invented by his father, Larry Heffron. It also has a link to the fabulous Heftones website, which has our schedule. All of the music we have recorded thus far is actually downloadable on that website on heftone.com/fabulous.
Also on your website is your blog, Color Joy. How long have you been blogging, and what got you into blogging in the first place?
Wow, I've been blogging, I believe, since November. It was my birthday, November 28th of 2003, as I recall. Yes, 2003. It might have been 2002. Boy, it just all comes together. But I always wanted to write a column. I've always had things in my mind that I just had to tell somebody. And it makes sense. It falls through the family. My mother's mother wrote a column for a farmer's magazine in the 40s, which became so popular that her husband asked her to not do it anymore. She was becoming famous. Yeah, that's the nature of the 40s. Then my other grandmother wrote the entire newspaper. My grandfather owned a paper, and he was a printer. So grandmother wrote the paper, Grandma Ruthie, she wrote the paper, and grandpa printed it once a week. So it just makes sense that my dad had a journalism degree. He was a professor of journalism and then communications. It just makes sense that I would want to write. And yeah, I've never been short on words, as you know, Marie.
But you'll also post some fabulous pictures of your work on your blog and other things that you're doing as well. I remember seeing the entry where you'd photographed the trim on your house.
Oh, yes. I painted the trim of my house purple. I live in a neighborhood where there are several places where there are five white houses in a row, and it just didn't work for me. So I'm very fortunate to have this fabulous partner, Brian, my husband, who says, oh, do whatever you like, I'll like it. So he buys the paint, and I do whatever I want. And I painted the trim purple and kind of a salmon color, and that seemed to work pretty well. I fortunately am in a neighborhood where people don't protest when you paint silly things. If I lived in a fancier neighborhood, they would go in the paper and try to make me change.
Well, we couldn't have that. Can't have anybody trying to change Lynn. Something else I wanted to ask you about is you recently went traveling. I think at the end of last year, you went traveling to Africa for about 5 weeks, I believe.
I did. I had a miracle. My friend Altu asked me to go a year before we went to Africa, and I told her I was totally committed to the idea, but I didn't know how, with my sort of airy-fairy lifestyle, how I was going to raise enough money to do it. And literally a miracle happened and money fell from the sky just when I needed it. And I went to Africa for 5 weeks. Got to go to people's homes. I got to eat their regular food. I got to meet people. I spent 5 weeks not understanding most of the language around me, which at first is fascinating. After 4 weeks, I think I was ready to understand more. Africa is an amazing place. Color is everywhere. There's just no fear of color at all anywhere. We went to three different countries that were very different. I was in Ethiopia for 3 weeks with Altu's friends and family. We stayed with her parents. And I was in Kenya for 1 week. And I was in Egypt for 1 week. And talk about the difference between the people look different, they speak different languages, they have different clothing, although there are similarities too. There's a lot of wrapping in fabric no matter where you go. But in Ethiopia, the fabrics are hand spun, hand woven, hand embroidered. And the only machine work you find are the seams. And not all of the seams are even, some of them are hand done as well as commercial fabrics that are hand dyed. And they have embroidery which is done on a machine which has to be hand controlled. And then when you go to Egypt, some of the clothing I bought in Egypt actually had computerized embroidery on it. So it was just really interesting to compare the different fabrics and garments and languages and cultures, and I felt very, very welcome everywhere. I never felt that I wasn't welcome. Some people would feel like that was a scary thing, but people are people. Everybody loves their children. Everybody wants to have peace. You know, we're so alike. We don't speak the same languages. We have different cultures. We have different traditions, and then we sometimes are insulted by other people's traditions. But when you get right down to it, people like to laugh a lot, you know?
Did you see any examples of knitting while you were there?
I saw almost no knitting at all, Marie. When I was in Ethiopia, I did not see any knitting that was hand knitting or no spinning, although they do spin, I didn't see it. When I was in Kenya, I did see some lovely little hand-knit animals that were for sale in a little native craft store in a fancy mall in Nairobi. And we also went to a market in Nairobi. It was at a mall, but it was an outdoor space behind the mall. There was a woman who was doing some hand spun and making hats. They were very, very coarse and very, very primitive. And I wish I had bought some of that. I would have liked to buy a hat for my friend Tony, but myself, I was afraid to bargain, so I let that go. In Egypt, I bought a little bit of yarn. It was commercial yarn. I think it was Italian yarn, actually, but I bought it in Alexandria. There were some shops where you could buy, but most of it was acrylic. I found some mohair blend that I bought. And in Egypt, you find hats made of tapestry crochet, which I bought a few of those. I also bought a lady's fez, which is really lovely and soft and beautiful. But I found when I was knitting in Ethiopia in a home, I was just sitting there knitting, and a guest came to visit. And his first response was, "Why are you doing that? That's what peasants do." I had to kind of think for a minute because, of course, to me, it's what artists do. And no one's ever thought I was a peasant. You know, I'm a white girl from a suburb. I told him it's no crime to be a peasant, but take a look at this sock I've designed. Altu had me go to the other room where I had designed some very, very fancy socks. My Ethiopian basket sock has three colors on some rows. It looks like a basket that they make in Ethiopia that they use for their dinner tables sometimes. And it has an Ethiopian flag for the heel. It's just a lovely, beautiful thing. And he had never seen any knitting like that at all. So he then, I think, understood that it's art for someone who has the leisure to purchase clothing for themselves instead of make their own.
Celine, what are your plans for the future?
Wow, you know, I do sort of follow the muse as much as I can, so there's no doubt there are more socks in my future. But right now, my friend Susan Hensel, who again was instrumental with my felt making project, Sue and I are in the very beginning plans of doing a sculptural and or kind of a tapestry sort of knitting exhibit. I hope we'll have wall pieces and sculptures, basically not your grandmother's knitting. But we will be doing a call for art for this piece by September at some time. So it's part of this exhibit. They should send me an email at lynn@colorjoy.com, or they can go to susanhenseldesign.com, and that's H-E-N-S-E-L is Susan's last name.
And that was Lynn Hirschberger from colorjoy.com. And if you're interested in entering a piece of that exhibition, you'll find links for it and everything else mentioned during that interview via the Knitcast blog at www.knitcast.com. Knitting has long had an association with charity, and the images of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina spurred bloggers Margene and Susan into action. Their relief effort, Give a Little, uses a similar system to Yarn Harlot's Knitters Without Borders. Basically, you make a donation to the American Red Cross and then email Give a Little to let them know how much you donated. You're then entered into a weekly competition where you could win knitting-related prizes. Go to Zneedle, that's zneedle.typepad.com/give_a_little to find out more. The Afghans for Afghans project is appealing for knitted items made from wool yarns for children in Afghanistan. A very harsh winter is approaching, and Afghans for Afghans hope to clothe 5,000 Afghani children. The deadline to send items in is fast approaching. They must be received by September the 16th in order to be sent to Afghanistan in time. It's especially important that the items are made from wool yarns. Acrylic just isn't warm enough in the severe cold of an Afghan winter. You can find out more information, including the address to send items, by going to www.afghansforafghans.org. And in another example of the power of the online knitting community, knitters worldwide have joined forces to raise money for Oliver, the son of Emma, from the blog Emma & Co. Oliver is disabled and needs special equipment that's just far too expensive for Emma and her family to afford. So far, money has been raised for a car seat and a special trike for Oliver, but more money is needed for an electric wheelchair that would really give him some independence and freedom. Find out more by going to emma.prettyposies.com. And of course, links for all of these charities are on the Knitcast blog at www.knitcast.com. Now, recently updated the upcoming guests list at knitcast.com. You'll see some very interesting names there. And I want to hear your questions for these guests. You can email them and any other comments to feedback@knitcast.com. And before I go, I've received some emails from iTunes users asking me where they can find editions 1 through 5 and number 9. Now, for some reason, they don't show up in iTunes, but you can download them manually by looking in the archives on knitcast.com. Well, I'm Maria Urshard, and that was Knitcast. Thanks for listening.